You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina.
Well, hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast Feminan. This is the June episode, and I'm going to have to start with an apology, a bit of a grovelling apology, that last month I promised us a Swiss chalet, didn't I, to be broadcasting from, and I've totally failed. I'm not in a Swiss chalet, I'm not in a cabana. My two co-hosts are down the line, but I can see that, you know, Denny Gray of the British Continental, you have done a great effort appearing on our Zoom call in a Swiss chalet.
I have. I thought I'd jet out to Switzerland. Despite my environmentalism, I jetted out privately here in my Swiss chalet at the top of the mountains. I should have invited you to, really, shouldn't I? It's a bit rude of me not to. It's a huge, huge chalet paid for by my uncle Friedrich, who invented the Toblerone. Or is it just a background I put on Zoom? That will leave you guessing for the rest of the episode, I'm sure.
I love, because we had a lot of fun talking about this Swiss chalet backdrop that Denny is in. And Denny was like, well, we can't talk about it on the podcast. It's a visual gag. It just will never work. But we went for it anyway. We're really trying anyway. And Rebecca Charlton, who's also missed out on the Swiss chalet. How are you doing, Rebecca? I'm sure I would love to have offered you some raclette in this sweltering weather, but I'm afraid I can't. That can't be done. And some van show, of course.
I tried to put a background on my Zoom screen, but it crashed the computer, so I haven't done as well as Denny. But I am going to be in Gstaad. I have to practice saying that correctly. Obviously, I've missed the opportunity to be at the Tour de Suisse, but I'm out there for an event called La Renne next week, so I'm literally going to be in a chalet.
Oh,
a
yes,
real chalet.
A real proper chalet. And, you know, the reason we were going to be in the Swiss chalet is...
Sorry, Denny. Let's not fall out. It's not Christmas.
That's true. Yeah, we have to save that animosity for that kind of the Christmas time of year. But yes, we were going to be in our finding a Swiss chalet, weren't we? Because we are going to be talking about the Tour de Suisse. Lots to talk about from the Tour de Suisse, but also from the Tour of Britain Women. That will be coming up. We also have a really fantastic feature this month. And I can say that because I didn't have hardly any part in it. And that is an interview that we've got with Lisa Brambaini, who was a rider back in the 80s, 90s. She's in conversation with Tom Wally for actually something that's going to be released as a Friends of the Podcast episode, their full conversation. But we're just taking a few snippets from it about her experiences at the Giro d'Italia back in 1988. And about, you know, I mean, it's amazing to hear her stories and anecdotes and how far racing has come. But yeah, that's some great listen that will be later on. And before we, another false start for you all, and that is because I just wanted to wish Molly Weaver fantastic, well, all the best tailwinds on her record attempt to do a circumnavigation of the Great British coastline. Molly Weaver probably is familiar to listeners. She was a pro cyclist a few years ago, coming up through the ranks, and she had a really devastating crash in training, broke 13 bones, and has been really candid on the podcast before about kind of how that crash set her into depression and all her mental health struggles. And she's found ultra racing now and is now taking on what is an absolutely mammoth effort. The record stands by Nick Sanders from 1981 as 22 days to cover about 7,730 kilometres. She said that it's going to be riding for 18-hour days to achieve that. But you can follow along with Molly and find out, you know, how she's doing and where she is. There's a little pinpoint that goes around a map, so you can see exactly where she is at any point. She's somewhere on the south coast at the moment. But yes, just wanted to wish Molly all the best on that effort from the Cycling Podcast and from me personally. Well, should we get on with talking about what we wanted to talk about to my co-hosts? And I set you a rather interesting way of tackling what have been some momentous occasions, haven't they, in the last few races. And that was setting you the task of coming up with a few things that made you go, ooh. And I...
Who's going to sing this?
I immediately regretted it on the WhatsApp group because all I got was a load of puns back. But I'm hoping that someone has done something. And to be clear, not things that make you go, hmm, which is the song, but things that make you go, ooh. Denny, what thing made you go, ooh? And you can take ooh however you like. So, Denny, roll us off with what thing made you go, ooh,
well,
in the recent race?
There were many, many moments. I have to say, it's been just a great few weeks of racing. And I've really, really enjoyed the TV and watching women's racing. It's been really, really exciting. We kind of downplayed the Tour of Britain, but what a great race it was. And what my moment, I think I'll start with Lizzie Deignan, because she was riding her last, well, it was her last race on British soil. Huge moment. It feels like Lizzie Deignan has been around forever. And she's been such a trailblazer in women's road racing. And to see her ride on the roads of Britain, animate the race quite often. She was a real team player throughout, just a brilliant role model for so many riders, including the younger generation, which were riding alongside her in that race. But the thing that really kind of stood out for me was not just her teamwork, but reading Mara Roldan's Instagram post after she'd had a horrendous crash on stage three, breaking her femur, and Mara Roldan described how Lizzie had sat on the roadside with her after the crash, holding her hands to give her support through that, what she described as a scary moment. It must have been horrendous. I mean, anyone who saw that crash on TV probably heard some of the screams from the riders. It was something that kind of pierced right through me. But yeah, for me, that just showed what a brilliant human being Lizzie Deignan is, to just forget about the racing and just to be there with a kind of young up-and-coming rider at her side when she needed it most. It was just a really beautiful moment.
Yeah, just to be clear, I mean, Lizzie Deignan and Mara Roldan aren't teammates, trade teammates. They're not, Mara is Canadian, Lizzie is British. They're not even, you know, national team teammates. So that was, you know, for her to go above and beyond, I think that was. Yeah, I mean, it does give testament to, you know, how phenomenal she is as a human being. And we say about, you know, how fantastic she is as a pioneer, as a racer. But also, you know, we kind of looked at last year, didn't we, about motherhood and the riders that have come back from maternity leave. And that was all started off by Lizzie Deignan, kind of putting that system in place that there would be maternity leave and riders would be able to come back as mothers. But, you know, all of these things off the bike, we shouldn't downplay what a fantastic champion she is. I mean, a Paris-Roubaix champion, and she used to be the only right, you know, she used to be part of that kind of bold Stolman squad. That's kind of the precursor to SD Works, that used to always be just ripping the legs off everyone else. I mean, she's a former world champion. I mean, it's just remarkable who she is as a person and as a racer.
Yeah, such a remarkable rider. I mean, we could talk all episode about just her, couldn't we? Because her palmarès is so long and her list of achievements is so great. I, you know, have a personal memory of standing in the rain in 2012 in Putney, watching her go past racing against Marianne Vos in the Olympics to get a silver medal on that day. But yeah, she just always just, it feels like she's been there for such a long time. She's been such a figurehead in many ways, as I know we'll come on to in a minute. It was a changing of the guard in this race, because we saw a couple of riders, one rider in particular, come to the fore, one young British rider. And so that, for British fans, that will give them a lot of hope that there's kind of riders able to take over Lizzie's mantle in the future.
How are you doing your ooh there, Denny, when talking about Lizzie Deignan? How are you approaching your ooh there? Mm.
You're
really thinking
speechless.
About it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Well, we have to, I am surprised that you led with the Lizzie Deignan, because I know there is something you're itching to talk about. Becca, can you give us your moment that made you go, ooh, or mm, or ooh? No, not mm. Mm is not allowed. It has to be an ooh. Sorry. I overstepped the mark there. It has to be an ooh. Go on, Becca, give us your moment of recent weeks.
It's been so difficult for me to not sing for the last 5 minutes, just because we reminded ourselves of that. I'm going to say must have been a 1980s something song, or was it 90s? Things that make you go, But we're going to obviously change it to ooh. But I always thought it was ooh, actually. But anyway, I'm going to stop singing because that's not what anyone's here to hear. Surprisingly, no. My ooh moment, although it was a little bit more enthusiastic than that at the time, was the final stage of the Tour of Britain Women, and watching that final play out between Kat Ferguson and Ali Wollaston, and it coming down to who was going to take each battle on the intermediate sprints. And then I think my ooh moment was when Kat Ferguson was doing a little rear tire bounce, and everyone was speculating as to whether she had a mechanical problem, but she carried on for quite a lot of time, didn't she, a long time after that. And then we saw her dismount, lay the bike down in the road, and I think at that point you couldn't actually see that she was, from the camera shot I was watching anyway, you couldn't see that she was laying it down in front of the team car. So I was like, oh my God, what's happening? She's decided to like discard her bike in the road. But actually it was executed to perfection. And I think what it really said to me that moment was the kind of technical nous that both of those riders brought to that final stage, and it just being battled out all the way to the line. And there's probably a lot to talk about in terms of the strength of teams in how that was ultimately won for Ali Wollaston, but I think it was a really exciting stage. And I think you said this very briefly, Denny, that when we were talking about the Tour of Britain Women, we were kind of sort of, yeah, maybe downplaying it a little bit, saying we might be able to predict how things are going to play out on some of these stages. But it proved to be completely unpredictable, came right down to the wire. And I think, yeah, the technical sense of riding that both those riders brought to that final stage, I was absolutely on the edge of my seat the whole time.
Yeah, we should set the scene there a bit, because Kat Ferguson basically went in as the overall leader, didn't she, on the final stage, having won the stage before. But we'll just pass by that fact, won't we, very, very quickly.
I may come back to that, Denny, Rose.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if we have time. Oh, you're breaking up, Denny. You're breaking up. So Kat Ferguson had a 3 second lead, didn't she, on Ali Wollaston coming to that final day. And there was three intermediate sprints where there's opportunity to get bonus seconds. And there was the finish as well, where there were more seconds on the line. And that was really thrilling. I mean, that lit up the intermediate sprints, didn't it? Because we had Ali Wollaston and Kat Ferguson going against each other. And actually, Ali Wollaston came on top, did exactly what she needed to do, didn't she? But she came out on top in every single one of those intermediate sprints to make it level pegging going into that final sprint. Then Ali Wollaston came third, so she got the bonus seconds there to take the overall lead. But I do wonder if, you know, how much also we should talk about maybe a little bit, not naivety on Kat Ferguson's part, because she's such a young rider, but maybe she was kind of, it's quite a learning lesson, wasn't it, for her on that final stage, Becca, because it's quite a major thing to suddenly end up in the leader's jersey, and then you have to try and look after that jersey on that final stage when there is so much, it was, you know, a circuit race, there was so much chaos going on.
Yeah, I think you're right. If you were going to write the ideal dream scenario for it being that close, that would be it, wouldn't it? You know, it literally came down to those final bonuses. And that's what I absolutely loved about it. But I have given it quite a lot of thought, because I think the narrative, like the obvious narrative that people were saying, is Kat Ferguson's a very, very young rider. She's got experience to gain in these races. But actually looking back at how FDJ rode it, they had the strength in numbers. They gave a full lead out to Ali Wollaston to secure it. So actually, I do think it, you know, rider on rider, without looking at the setup around them, I think they were really evenly matched in how they played it. But ultimately, Wollaston had the strength along with the team to take the victory, is my ultimate opinion on it.
Yeah, I think Wollaston's the stronger sprinter out and out. You know, put them on a flat run in and you'd expect Wollaston to win, and that's what she showed in that final stage. I don't think it was naivety on the part of Ferguson. Clearly she does have a lot still to learn, but what she showed us at the Tour of Britain was how much she knows already, and how mature she was. And she rode it brilliantly. Somebody predicted, I think in the January episode, that in one of their bold predictions, that she may win a World Tour race this year. And she did just that. I can't remember.
Was
who,
it me,
who
Denny?
Made that
was
prediction.
It me that?
We'd have
me?
To listen back, yeah. Wouldn't we, Rose? I think it was the same person.
It
was
it that said that?
But Peterser may get her first big major classics win this year as well, wasn't it?
How have we gone this long without you mentioning it?
Yeah, it's mad. I would have thought that Denny was going to even, you know, just jump the gun in the intro and mention the fact that your bold predictions
Becca
has come true
already.
Well, Becca
said she wanted to talk about Kat Ferguson pre-recording, so I was just being generous and not waiting for that. But anyway, there we go. She rode a brilliant race, and she's got a lot to be proud of. The thing you have to remember is she's only just turned 19. She's still a first year pro, and just a brilliant performance. And I think the thing we have to keep telling ourselves is that she's got hopefully a long career ahead of her. We shouldn't put too much expectation on her, but it just goes to show what a great talent she is at such a young age. And it was as you said, Becca, I think the racing was so exciting, and who would have predicted that it would go down to the wire like that? When I looked at the course and saw a flattish circuit race in Glasgow, I have to say I was quite disappointed by that final stage. I thought it was going to be a real damp squib, but actually the way it ended up was brilliant. And the other thing we should say about Ferguson, when she did win that stage, it was at the end of a really long, hard, I think it's 143-kilometer stage. In the driving rain, there were crashes left, right and centre. It was, I don't like using the word epic, but it felt like a real epic stage, didn't it? And she won that. She was the one who had the endurance and the stamina to win that sprint when Wollaston kind of ran out of energy, basically, in the cold and the wet. Ferguson came through, much like she did in Spain with the Navarra Classic, another win in the rain. So she's clearly somebody who does well in those really tough conditions, maybe kind of something to do with her kind of Yorkshire blood. But fantastic performance.
Well, talking about changing of the guard, and that's another convenient segue back to that, isn't it? Because actually, the amount of times I've interviewed Lizzie Deignan and said, you must love today because it's just absolutely horrendous weather. And she's well documented, isn't it? She's done so well in the rain when everybody else has been freezing and depleted, and she's just like, bring it on. And I think that's what we saw with Kat Ferguson that day as well. But I think, we've focused in on Ferguson, but I want to just have a word about Ali Wollaston as well, because of course she did take that victory. And then I was in commentary for the Tour Féminin International des Pyrénées, the Women's Tour of the Pyrenees, for 3 days, and she then went on the bounce straight in to take the sprint on stage one, a reduced sprint in the opening stage of that race. And that's a race that has had its issues. It's quite a young race, it's only in its fourth edition, and I think two editions ago, there were safety issues. There'd been cars, traffic on the course, and a lot of the riders said, right, including Ashley Mormont-Passier, right, we're not going to field this race. It's not safe. And then it's evolved and it's come back stronger and stronger in the last two editions. So I think it will potentially become a more significant race on the calendar, and to see Wollaston go in with that confidence and take stage one, she's in a good place as well.
Yeah, she's definitely built some confidence there, hasn't she, at Tour of Britain, that to go and win at in the Pyrenees. I've got a thing that made me go, ooh, ooh, that's what I'm going to go for. And that was at the Tour of Britain Women as well, which is getting, you know, plenty of coverage, actually, after I poo-pooed it last month.
Sorry. really bad. Sorry.
Oh, gosh. Let's hope that doesn't make the cut, shall we? But I wanted to give a huge amount of plaudits to Mara Roldan. We touched on her earlier. Denny mentioned the crash has kind of taken away the suspense somewhat from what I'm about to say. But she won on stage two. Just such a remarkable performance, because she went solo with about 14 kilometres to go and then was being chased down by Rhianna Marcus. And what I just loved about Mara Roldan is that she doesn't make it look easy at all. She is literally, from the attack, which was all set up by her team, she is bouncing around on that bike. Her mouth is wide open. She's lolling about. She's going side to side. she really makes it look like she has got nothing in the tank, and she probably didn't have anything much left in the tank, but she just kept going and going and going. And I just love this Rihanna Marcus, this kind of torpedo setting off behind her, totally rock solid, just, you know, her legs just going like a metronome. And but she couldn't catch up with Mara Roldan at the front. That's what I absolutely loved about that. It was like seeing two very different styles of racer. And the one that came on top was the one that really made it look difficult. And that's why I just loved it. So much passion as a racer that she had to go out and win in that way. And I like that, because it also makes me think, like, you know, it's nice to see the person who's obviously, you know, not to say that she's not, you know, built in the image of the perfect cyclist, but you see someone like Rihanna Marcus on a bike and you can't think that she could even exist off of a bike. She looks so perfect on a bike and perfect and stable on it. But I just love those riders. A bit like Annemiek van Vleuten, actually. Mm. She used to always make it. You could see every ounce of effort that was going into that bike. And same again with Mara Roldan. I thought she was just absolutely remarkable, giving it all, and then just a fantastic crossing the line and then looking so surprised after the line and so shocked that she had done it. 21-year-old Canadian with a bit of, you know, in her first year on a world tour team. So I thought she was fantastic. Denny, what did you make of that on stage two?
Yeah, the thing that struck me was just that contrast you highlighted there, Rose, with Rihanna Marcus, who just looks just perfect on a bike, you know. If you'd imagine the perfect cyclist cycling, it would be Rihanna Marcus, wouldn't it? And Mara Roldan, not quite onomatopoeic, because that's when a word sounds like makes a noise, it sounds like. But she was certainly rolling around, wasn't she? And from side to side, it was fantastic to watch. I absolutely loved it. I loved that, because you kind of can almost see the emotion on her as she's riding, and also a big moment for that team as well, because Picnic Postanel had a pretty poor season up until then. Really, that was, you know, the first World Tour win. I think it might have even been their first UCI road race win of the year. So that was an important moment. We'd flagged, didn't we, in the previous episode, that, of course, this race could be the type of race where we'd see some breakthroughs, see some riders getting some wins that we hadn't previously seen. And certainly with Mara Roldan, that was a big breakthrough moment. In fact, the whole race felt like it was full of breakthroughs, really, partly because of bad luck. There were riders kind of doing well, then kind of ruled out by crashes. Kim LeCourt, Christian Faulkner, Cecily Ludwig were all kind of foiled by crashes or punctures at bad moments in the race. But it meant that we had riders like Kat Ferguson, Mara Roldan, and others coming to the fore. And it provided some really exciting racing as a result.
And we should say that Mara Roldan, unfortunately, had a crazy 24 hours, because on the stage straight after the one that she won, she then came down in that crash with 56 kilometers to go, really wet. I mean, the rain looked absolutely horrific, really wet, slippery roads. She came down, she was kind of third rider, wasn't she, on the road, and she was the first to go down. And then Faulkner went down, and a few other, Barbara Gorisi went down. Huge crash. A broken femur, which is an awful, awful, awful injury. So, I mean, you know, what a roller coaster of emotions there. But also, you know, she's got quite a long way of recovery. Luckily, the team has said surgery went well and she's just focused on recovery now, which is great to hear. But we were all very worried about her, weren't we, in that crash.
Hello, Ned Bolting here. If you, like me, think that the journey is just as important as the destination, then can I interest you in my latest book, The Accidental Tourist? This memoir spreads its wings beyond the confines of just the Tour de France, as a quarter century of covering cycling takes me all around the world, following skinny men and women racing bikes very fast. There's chapters on life at the Giro, the growth of women's racing, and memories of Chris Froome and Mark Cavendish. The Accidental Tourist is out now and available from all good bookshops and audiobook retailers.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
I feel like we're all tiptoeing in our moments that went made us go ooh, tiptoeing around an absolutely major one from the Tour de Suisse. I feel like we're all trying to go for the kind of hipster interesting, you might have missed this little interesting moment, but we are totally not talked about so far. Huge win for Marlon Reusser over Demi Vollering at the Tour de Suisse. I mean, two stage wins for Marlon Reusser and the overall. Rebecca, that must have made you go ooh in some kind of form. Give us your ooh for that
big
moment.
It did, and it is written down here in front of me as my thing that made me go ooh. And I was absolutely screaming at the TV screen on the last stage, and it was brilliant. It was so good. And we've talked many times this season about how things are getting better and better and closer and more animated. But I didn't, coming into this season, expect this battle to even be that close with Vollering and Reusser, let alone the dynamic that we're now seeing unfold now. And I think my first ooh moment was the closing kilometer on stage one of the Tour de Suisse, when the two in the front, Reusser and Vollering, had enough of a gap then to start playing the games. They knew they weren't going to be caught in that closer. But I couldn't hear what Marlon Reusser was saying to Vollering. Could either of you make that out? Because I really, really wanted to hear what she was saying. Because again, as we've talked about with Anna van der Breggen and Vollering having been very close in SD Works, of course you've got the same dynamic there with Reusser, and I just fascinated to know what she was saying, because she just completely sat up and just rolled and started the game playing, didn't she? And I think that the reason I picked that moment, because I feel like that started really that battle that we saw right until the end, and that final nail-biting stage where I think that Marlon Reusser just had this swagger, I think is the right word about her. Once she had the confidence and she knew that had played out in that way on stage one, it was kind of like, bring it on. And she just seemed to be having a lot of fun with it. And I think entertainment-wise, as I say, this is some of the best dynamics of the racing we've seen ever in women's cycling.
It was a fantastic race, wasn't it? And what really struck me, really made me go ooh, maybe at the end of the I'm not really a person really who says ooh naturally, so
yeah, you're really not wanting to say ooh.
No it
all
doesn't come.
Give it some oomph.
Oomph. Oh, very good. Yeah. Well, Reusser was certainly oozing with confidence, but by the end of that race. But what I loved about the race was the fact that it wasn't actually won on the climbs. It was the descents and the flats that decided the race, and that was a lot to do with Reusser and the way she took her opportunities. Stage one was won essentially by an attack on that descent. 60 kilometers out, she forced Vollering to chase. Vollering kind of used up a lot of energy to get back on terms. And then Reusser outplayed her, didn't she, in that finale. And Reusser also then started the mind games on stage two, because on stage two, we had an attack from Nivea Doma on a climb about 20 kilometers out. And Reusser sat back, and afterwards, she criticised Vollering for not chasing Nivea Doma. She said, I need to think about how to formulate this, or something along those lines. And said, I would say that Demi doesn't really take much responsibility, and I think she panics a lot. And if she acts a bit more normally in the race, we don't end up in dangerous situations. And that was, I found that fascinating, because they're riders who, when you watch them on camera after the race, they seem to get on well, but that was a bit of a jibe at Vollering, and I don't know if that played on Vollering's mind, because then later on in the race and stage four, when you're talking about Vollering's brilliant win again, we had Reusser tactically outplaying Vollering, didn't we, when Nivea Doma again was on the attack, and Reusser forced Vollering to chase. Vollering used up her energy, and then Reusser attacked her and dropped her. And yeah, fantastic. It was really, really enjoyable. Really, I absolutely love that racing. Fantastic.
I think they're kind of psychologically on totally different ends of the spectrum, aren't they? Because Demi is so... what we love about watching her race is that she is so vulnerable, isn't she? And she has had these kind of moments in the past few years where it felt like it should have been her, but it wasn't because of, you know, X, Y, and Z. And Marlon Reusser is just so resilient and so kind of like, well, I'm going to give it a go. And if it, you know, if I fail, you know, who cares? Whatever. I don't care who's watching and I don't care what anyone thinks about it. You know, she really has that kind of mental, yeah, just kind of like natural confidence, doesn't she? That she's going to always make the right decision. And even if people object, don't think it's the right decision, then she's probably right anyway. You know, and I think that is really hard for Demi Vollering because she's going to be constantly second guessing herself now. And she probably wasn't thinking at the beginning of the year that Marlon Reusser was going to be this biggest GC rival that she's got. She was probably kind of always thinking about Anna van der Breggen and thinking about how she could kind of overcome her. And now Marlon Reusser is this huge, huge GC favourite and has beaten her. In fact, obviously, we didn't have those mammoth climbs, did we, in the Tour de Suisse, like we will see later on in the Tour de France. But it's just been kind of a step change, hasn't it, for Marlon Reusser this year? She started off in Valenciana, was it? And she was kind of going up against Van der Breggen and Vollering. And there it seemed like she was always keeping a little bit in the tank because she always thought that Vollering or Van der Breggen might get the better of her. And then as we've gone through, she kind of has established herself as doing better in the mountains than Van der Breggen. And now she's in a GC race and she's beating Demi Vollering, who really had nothing left. There was no bluffing or anything, or, you know, she really, Vollering really gave it her all. And like, you know, we saw at the finish line, she was totally empty and just desperate. I mean, she looked like she was falling asleep as the interviewer was talking to her at the finish line. I mean, she was really had nothing left. I mean, it was so remarkable from Marlon Reusser, was it? And you just don't know now. I mean, like with Vollering, you kind of know where she's going to attack because she's going to attack on a climb and, you know, that. But with Reusser, she could attack on a descent. She could attack on the flat. And, you know, it adds such a huge dimension to the racing, doesn't it, to have Marlon Reusser and Vollering going up against each other and Van der Breggen.
It really does. I mean, Vollering, I have to say, she did say after that race that she was exhausted. She said, I'm empty, it's time to sleep. She talked about maybe having a virus, and it was the end of a long block of racing for her, which has been hugely successful. She raced the Ardennes and then she won the Vuelta. She won at Zulia, she won Catalunya, and then she came to the Tour de Suisse. So I think it's believable when she says she was tired, she's exhausted. She's clearly going to go away, go to altitude, prepare for the Tour de France fam, and I'm sure she'll come back. The Demi Vollering we know very, very well, who's just, you know, unmatchable on her best on those climbs, isn't she? But as you say, Rose, I think what's exciting about this is you have riders like Marlon Reusser. Nivea Doma was really opportunistic. She, I guess, be uncharitable to say she threw the race away on stage one, but all the other favourites kind of lost out by that attack from Reusser, didn't they, on stage one? Lost a lot of time as a result. But Nivea Doma was very active. She seemed to be coming back to the kind of shape that won her the Tour de France fam last year. So they're both riders who were willing to attack when you least expect them to. So I think it goes to show, yeah, we shouldn't just assume that Vollering, if she's at her best, will walk the Tour this year.
No, not at all. And actually, some insight that I had at the beginning of the Tour of the Pyrenees as well was a lot of the start list changed at the last minute because quite a few teams lost riders to illness who'd done the Spanish block. And it was, yeah, quite well documented that there was quite a lot of illness going around at some of those races that they'd all come from. So as you say, I think obviously Vollering was talking about feeling utterly depleted and needing to look to the next phase after a rest. So that was interesting to have that. But like you've both said, in terms of the dynamic of it and Vollering being far from able to just ride away from Reusser, in your mind, that's got to completely shift things. And as I said before, I do think that Reusser was kind of just throwing different game playing at it and just getting more and more and more sure of herself in that sense. And I was interested to know if you thought that Vollering could have played it differently on that final stage. So interesting to hear you both say you just think that she actually gave it everything she had and it wasn't necessarily a tactical mistake. She was just that's all she had on the day.
I think she did. And I think she's just not used to going up against Marlon Reusser. And, you know, they are talking on the bikes during the race. And I'm sure Marlon could be saying things that is making Vollering second guess herself and is making her think, oh, wait a minute, I came into this being like the out and out favourite. I should be the absolute leader. I should be untouchable. And now I'm not. And, you know, it's a challenge that's coming from a place that I wasn't even aware of at the beginning of the season. So it just makes it all the more thrilling for the Grand Tours that we have got coming up. And on that note, I should segue into our mini feature this month, because the next Grand Tour, of course, is the Giro d'Italia. We're a few weeks away from it, but it will be the next kind of major race on the World Tour calendar. Let me introduce our mini feature, which is Tom Walley talking to Lisa Brambaini about the Giro d'Italia Femminile back in 1988, a year of many firsts in a changing world. But in cycling, it marked the beginning of the first women's Giro d'Italia. Lisa Brambaini was a red-hot talent on the British cycling scene. She rode that maiden Giro, but it wasn't the homecoming her name suggests.
I wasn't aware that my name probably looked to them, oh, this girl's British, but she's Italian, you know, she's got an Italian name. And it wasn't until probably about 20 years ago that I actually delved a bit more into my Italian heritage.
Lisa, a four-time British national champion, spoke to the cycling podcast producer Tom Walley as they pored over a rare record of those often unreported days, her very own diary.
So, can you see how small the writing is?
Oh, that is incredible.
So I've got every day from the Giro Italia. Every day.
Oh, listen, it's good because you know what? You've got more info there than pro cycling stats.
You just didn't know about the races. You got the results from the race you've done about 4 weeks later, you know. So it was, if you weren't there, you didn't know about it. I wouldn't have even known that there was a men's race, probably. I was just so naive, really was. The guys at the cycling club would have known, you know, but they wouldn't have probably even thought, do you know what you're doing here? You know, you don't know what they... I didn't even know it was the first one until you told me.
Despite it being a first ever Giro, it hardly ushered in a new level of professionalism.
Would have just been a van with seats in it, you know. I don't think it would... In fact, it was probably even... A lot of the time we were just in an estate car that was the team manager's estate car that he'd brought over. I've got some fabulous pictures of these old estate cars and fabulous shell suits that we used to wear. And it's just, you look at them now and you think, God, how did we go out looking like that? It wasn't great. You know, we used to get your kit at the start of the race and then you'd give it back at the end of the race and you'd get some more at the next race. God knows whose kit it was. Got there, badly organised, breakfast badly organised, everything badly organised. And then it said, race start, had to wait 10 minutes because the Chinese had got lost. Started the race, Chinese still not here. Started the race. Road 11 kilometres neutralised. This is what I said in my thing. Road 11 kilometres neutralised. And then found out that the 11 kilometres was on top of the 136 kilometres of the race. Then it turns out that the Chinese never got to the race start, couldn't start the race. So they, every day, what they did was they set off an hour before us, rode the race before us, got to the hotel, used all the hot water. And we'd end up with cold showers every night because the Chinese had used all the hot water washing the bikes in the showers. And we were sleeping in big, like, dormitories, almost like hospital wards we were sleeping in. And I think We were lucky we must have had a masseuse there, but I've put in my diary, didn't bother having my legs rubbed tonight. You know, what professional cyclist doesn't bother having the legs rubbed, you know? Just so unprofessional. We got to one place where it was a convent, and I thought, in my memory, this convent was awful, but I've just looked in my diary and it actually said convent was really nice. Got our own rooms to ourselves, which was something else, you know, on a stage race.
Yeah, so you spent a night in a convent? Were there nuns there?
Yes, there were nuns there. The weather was terrible during this 88 Italian gyro, the first one. The first few days were horrendously bad weather. And when we were in the convent, there was a storm, and these nuns were running around with all the cloaks flowing all over, shutting these shutters on the windows. But anyway, so we got to this convent, and we're like, oh, God, it's going to be another cold shower again. And I'd got in the shower, and I had this really freezing cold shower, and, you know, I'd got out, and then one of the teammates got in after me. She said, oh, that was a nice shower, wasn't it? Really nice and warm. I was like, what are you talking about? They'd put the taps the opposite way around, hadn't they? So I was thinking it was the hot water tap. And we'd actually got hot water. That was used in the wrong tap. Oh, my word.
Yeah, yeah.
But what of Lisa's race? After the opening prologue in Milan, 8 stages followed, taking the riders down to the capital city.
I didn't actually know until reading my diary that I crashed on the first day of the race, banged up my knee really quite badly. Did rubbish. It was a bunch sprint. Didn't do much because I'd hurt my knee. Second day, I'd just floated in again. Third day, it was along the coast, I think, and it was really strong crosswinds, and I got blown off that day again and hit my other knee. And I was something like about in 23rd place, which, judging by what I'd written, I wasn't very happy about that. So I've written in my diary, no one would echelon. No one would echelon. And it was just split into groups. And, God, I mean, that is my worst weather conditions. Flat, wind, not having much about you, you know. Riding with girls that probably didn't know how to echelon, even. It was really tough, but I absolutely clearly remember, without even rereading anything, the Dutch girls that day were hellish. They got on the front, and that was their thing. You know, the Dutch girls in those days weren't any good. They weren't any good at climbing. They were just good at going to the front of the race on a windy flat day and hammering it, because they were quite big. So they were big girls and they were able to do it. And I think they stick in my mind as being the girls for that sort of course, you know. Then it was a time trial, and it was an uphill time trial. And I finished third. I didn't know that, but I finished third on that day. And that put me up to 8th place.
By the finish on the cobbles in Rome, Lisa ended her race 9th overall, with the Maglia Rosa falling on the shoulders of the great Italian Maria Canins, adding the inaugural Giro d'Italia to her 2 Tour de France Féminin victories.
Whoa, I mean, she was just up there, you know. I don't think I ever even spoke to Maria. You know, Maria was scary. Proper scary, you know, she was a proper cyclist.
And what struck Lisa most looking back on the first Giro?
I was quite homesick. I've put in my diary that it was quite expensive to phone home as well. It was still in the time of lira. It was probably about 250,000 lira, because, you know, you used to get about 150,000 lira to the pound, didn't you? It was like so much money. I always look back at it as being a hard race, a tough race, a race that I didn't get a great result. So when I looked at that email and you said I was 9th is a great result, but I probably wasn't happy with it because I hadn't won it, you know, because I won the races in the UK and I just presumed I could win the races in Europe.
Hello, Ned Bolting here. If you, like me, think that the journey is just as important as the destination, then can I interest you in my latest book, The Accidental Tourist? This memoir spreads its wings beyond the confines of just the Tour de France, as a quarter century of covering cycling takes me all around the world, following skinny men and women racing bikes very fast. There's chapters on life at the Giro, the growth of women's racing, and memories of Chris Froome and Mark Cavendish. The Accidental Tourist is out now and available from all good bookshops and audiobook retailers.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Well, that was Lisa Brambaini talking to Tom Wally there, a producer on the Cycling podcast. And if you want to hear more from their conversation, which you really should, because there's some absolutely fantastic little details, and Lisa kind of goes through all about sort of her career highlights and how she got into racing back in the day. Yeah, it's a really fantastic, engaging listen. I really recommend that you go and listen to it. That will be out in the coming weeks for friends of the podcast. If you're not a friend of the podcast, then what are you doing? You should be a friend of the podcast, because that is just going to be one great listen amongst a whole range of great listens that we've already had this year and will have for the rest of the year. So fantastic to hear about the Giro back in 1988. The Giro has been organisationally, it's always been a little bit of an embarrassment over the years, but hopefully this year they won't be sleeping in a convent with nothing but cold water. We can only hope. But what do we know, Denny? What can we expect from the Giro that's coming up at the beginning of July? What are we looking at in terms of course?
Yeah, well, it starts on July 6th, runs to the 13th. We've got 8 stages, which has become the norm for that race in the last couple of years. The entire route is 939 kilometres, and we've got an increase in elevation from last year, so an extra 1,000 metres of climbing. But the key facts are that it starts with an individual time trial in Bergamo, 13.6 kilometres. It's got a couple of flat stages, so there are opportunities for an out-and-out sprinters, 3 what are classed medium mountain stages, and then 2 high mountain stages. The Queen stage comes on stage 7, so leaving the GC suspense until last, which finishes atop Monte Neroni. And then stage 8 is replays the World Championships road circuit race in 2020 that Anna van der Breggen, of course, won from Forlì to Imola. So we know that course. Anyone who watched that World Championship will remember that course and some fantastic helicopter footage with riders on top of the hills there. Produced some really exciting racing across the piece, actually. So that should be a pretty exciting finale to what we hope will be a good 8 days of racing. Of course, the Giro will come finishes just 13 days, I think, before the Tour de France Femme. So when it comes to start list, we'll have probably a very different cast of characters.
You say a great finale, but one of my bugbears is bike races finishing or even being on motor racing circuits. That I hate that. And the Giro on the men's side is always doing it. Like, I, you know, in my time, I've been to Imola, I've been to Monza, and they just, the cyclists always look so puny and tiny and slow on a motor racing circuit. So the rest of it is great, but I am just putting that out there. I really, really hate bike races on motor racing circuits.
And I don't like riding them. In the past, I've ridden a couple. One of them, I think, was Brands Hatch. And I always thought, well, it's going to be flat, it's going to be an easy day, but the drag is ridiculous. And as somebody that thinks a road bridge is a hill, I agree with you, Rose.
Less of it. We want less of it. It's a really interesting parcours, isn't it? Because we do have this, the mega, mega queen stage is the penultimate stage. And then we kind of have this bumpy stage. So if we're thinking about battles between riders like Vollering, not that Vollering's going to be there, but if we do kind of the climbers versus the puncteurs, there's kind of plenty up for grabs, isn't there, in this race for sure. Not so much, yeah, a couple of stages with the sprinters, but not loads for them. But yeah, what can we say about the, oh, we are still a few weeks out, aren't we? But Rebecca, you did so well, actually, with your prediction last month about the Tour de Suisse, when you looked down at the start list and you were just like, only one name on there, Marlon Reusser, so she should do pretty well. That actually was true. That actually came true. So I'm coming back
now.
To you. Yeah, I'm coming back to you with your insight on what is at the moment quite an empty start list, because we are still a couple of weeks to go before the Giro, aren't we?
Yeah, I did make the joke that she was the only one on the start list, so she would win, and it came true. So I'm going to just go with that tactic again. But yeah, overall, it's 1,000 meters more climbing. As you both said, there's a couple of opportunities that look to be out and out sprint potential stages. So we have got the likes of Wiebes for SD Works and Voss for Visma Lisa bike. But yeah, it is a very sparse start list at the moment. It does look like Reusser is down for Movistar, and it'll be interesting to see if that stays the same going into the race. But she is at the moment anticipated to be there. We know that Demi Vollering definitely isn't, as you say, Rose, because she said in her post-race interview after the Tour de Suisse, not only does she definitely need a rest now after that huge block, but she's going to altitude to really focus now on the Tour de France femme, Avec Zwift. So for her team, FDJ Suez, you've got Juliette Labousse down and Anavita Muzik at the moment.
And that's intriguing in itself, isn't it? Because, you know, we shall see, you know, we were kind of talking about the Vollering, Labousse, Muzik relationship at that team, and it has been working really, really well for all three of them, actually, so far this year. But it'll be interesting without Vollering whether Labousse and Muzik can make the same inroads as they have been on GC so far.
Mm. Yeah, Labousse has played the team role brilliantly, hasn't she, so far this year. But this should be a chance for her to have a leadership role. And her TTing seems to be really strong at the moment. She was second in Burgos behind Marlon, only Marlon Reusser beat her. Marlon Reusser is obviously a superb time trialist and amazing form, as we've already spoken about. So you'd expect her to start the race strongly. And if she can climb as well as she can climb, you'd have thought she'd be a really strong contender. Who knows? Maybe we'll get an FDJ clean sweep of Grand Tours if it goes well for them.
Yeah, it'll be really, really interesting because, I think before we knew that Vollering was making the transfer there, we were, of course, talking a lot, weren't we, about Labousse and Muzik and what they could do at the likes of the Tour de France farm. So, yeah, knowing how well that dynamics worked, it would be really good to see what they do when we know Vollering's not going to be there and how they play that one. The two of them as well, I think, being there together will be really interesting. For Team UAE ADQ, Elisa Longo-Borghini is down, as is Brody Chapman, that just won final stage of the Tour of the Pyrenees. Just add that in there. So Longo-Borghini back, which is fantastic. And currently for Team...
Yeah,
sorry,
defending.
Rose.
We should say she is the defending champion, isn't she, Elisa Longo-Borghini? And just as a reminder, last year was that phenomenal Giro, and it went down to the wire, didn't it, with Lisa Longo-Borghini trying to hold off Lotta Kopecky, who kind of, that was her kind of christening moment as, wow, Lotta Kopecky is a proper GC contender. But we actually don't, we're not sure at this point, are we, about who from SD Works is turning up. No doubt that they will have one of the big contenders, because we, at the beginning of the year, it was meant for Anna van der Breggen. She obviously crashed in one of the Spanish races. Apologies.
It's Zulia, I think it was.
Oh, well done, Denny, for remembering which one was which. Now we're not sure whether she's will be back. And Lotta Kopecky, we kind of all presumed that she would be at the Tour. But what if Anna van der Breggen can't do the Giro, you know, who will they be backing there? But we, you know, one thing we do know is that SD Works will be wanting to put on a really good performance, because it's been a little bit patchy from them, hasn't it, so far this season in comparison to how they've been in previous seasons anyway, should I say.
Yeah, we've managed to get talk for about 40 minutes, I think, without mentioning that team.
I know, phenomenal.
That must be a record in recent times. I mean, where have they been? Anna van der Breggen, of course, injured her wrist, didn't she, in Zulia. And I think she was due to target the Giro, but then I think things may be up in the air. So I think it partly depends on her recovery. I know both her and Capecchi were on a training camp in France together, but neither rode the Tour de Suisse. The whole SD Works team seems a bit of an unknown quantity when it comes to GC, at least. Luana Wiebes is still Luana Wiebes and still winning races, as she showed at the Tour of Britain. But yeah, it's that's the great unknown, isn't it, for everybody?
It would also be great to see Marlon Reusser, who should be there, but maybe because of her recent form, will be maybe targeting the Tour instead. But it'd be great to see her in the high mountains, to see her on some proper huge mountain passes and see how she fares on them, because it starts really well for her because it has a time trial. I know it's only short, it's only kind of 14 kilometers, but that works very well for her. The punchy stages work very well for her. And it's just a case of, like, you know, when she's there in the mountains, will she be able to actually be a kind of a take on that leadership role there? Because she has fared very well against the likes of Vollering and Van der Breggen. But, you know, when you perhaps don't have those out and out great climbers to hold onto the wheels of, you know, how do you approach it and, you know, what are you going to do? But, you know, because she is on the start list, isn't she, Becca? You're on Marlon Reusser watch.
I am. Yep, she's there.
So she's bound to do very well.
Well, bound to. Yeah, I think obviously we're just doing a lot of speculation, a lot of question marks. We've quite an empty start list at the moment. But for SD Works, they've currently got Harvey, Gorishi, Cecchini and Wiebes down. And so, yeah, that's the ultimate question mark, is where's Capecchi and where's Anna van der Breggen at? And yeah, this we'll probably find out tomorrow, and this won't age well. But it would be very, very good to see, if we want all our questions answered, it would be very good to see them go up against Marlon Reusser in her current form. But I guess, again, we've talked about it a lot, but it's testament to just the level rising in the calendar, isn't it? With so many huge stage targets back to back, and we're ultimately, I think, season upon season, going to see maybe the pattern change as to which big hitters take on which target ahead, so closely ahead of the Tour de France.
What is interesting also is that SD Works aren't going with just a pure focus for the Malia Rosa, though. I mean, the people that you said that are down on the start list, Becca, that they are effectively most of sort of Lorena Wiebes's sprint squad and lead out squad. So yeah, it's interesting that they're not kind of thinking, maybe we can't win absolutely everything, maybe we need to just be a little bit more focused when we go to these races. They're obviously not doing that. They obviously still want to take the sprint wins and the punchy wins and, you know, take the whole lot. So it'd be very interesting who gets added to that roster, won't it? We should say, actually, that it's interesting because this is the last time that, you know, historically, the Giro Rosa the Giro d'Italia women, I think it is it now. But historically, the women's Giro has always clashed with the men's Tour de France. But that is actually changing next year, isn't it, Denny? Historically, this has always been something that the female peloton has protested against a little bit, because obviously when you have, you're not going to have loads of eyeballs. You know, cycling isn't a huge, huge sport when you compare it to things like, you know, football or F1. But so it's not like you have just endless eyeballs to look at every single race that's going on. And the feeling in the past has been that with the Tour de France, all of the people who are even vaguely interested in cycling are going to watch that, and they are not going to have time to also catch up on or even simultaneously be watching the women's Giro. But that's changing next year, isn't it, Denny?
Yeah, a new calendar has been published last week as we speak, and the UCI have added one new race to the calendar, Dwars door Vlaanderen. So that will be a women's World Tour race from next season. But I guess the key thing is the change of date for the Giro d'Italia. That is essentially taking the slot which the Tour of Britain women had this year. It's going to run from the 30th of May to the 7th of June, which means it won't clash with the Tour de France, the men's Tour de France, and it will come with plenty of space before the Tour de France Femmes, so riders can feasibly do both races. It comes at the end of the Spanish blocker racing, so it might make a Vuelta Giro double a little bit harder. But I think that's really good news. It will give the race the space it deserves. It's always, until the Tour de France Femmes came about, it was always regarded as, you know, the grand tour in women's racing for such a long time, even if the organisational side of the race was quite poor at times. The later date for the Tour of Britain was actually, I asked British Cycling about this, they wanted that change. So that will move to the end of August, the 20th to the 23rd of August. And they wanted that because it will align that race with the men's Tour of Britain, which happens at the beginning of September. So there'll kind of be a period of racing, UCI racing in Britain around that time. I have spoken to a couple of team managers, British team managers, about that change. They didn't seem unhappy, but they did flag that there's a sentence in the calendar change announcement that the rules for participation in women's World Tour races and UCI Pro Series races will change next year to take account of the new pro team tier that appeared this year. And their concern is that UCI continental teams may be prevented from riding in women's World Tour races. And of course, as we've spoken about before, for UCI continental teams, appearing in a women's World Tour race is so important for gaining sponsorship and investment and exposure. It was the case for the British teams in the women's world, in the Tour Britain women, but the same applies to lots of other teams across Europe and the world. So that will, yeah, there's going to be a newsletter apparently published this week, which may be out by the time listeners are listening to this, which may say more about that. But that is the big worry in all these changes for some of the smaller teams. But for the bigger teams, I think the Giro switch makes perfect sense.
That could be very dangerous, couldn't it, Becca, for the smaller teams? Because and also, you know, on women's side of things, we don't have, like, you know, under 23 races. So it's a bit of an unusual move. You know, how are we expecting these kind of junior races and younger racers, new to the sport, riders to get experience if they can't be at these bigger races, when there aren't, we don't have, like, the men's side of things, where there are so many races and there are plenty of races for less experienced riders.
Yeah, there's so many limited opportunities, and Denny's spoken about this a lot on previous episodes. It's so crucial that the riders are exposed to this, and yeah, with very sparse opportunities. Yeah, it would be really, really sad to see that opportunity taken away, because it's so valuable. It's so, so valuable to the riders. But nodding to the overall calendar shift, you know, obviously in the bigger picture, it's very positive that it won't be, I guess, hidden behind the men's Tour de France anymore. And I remember quite some years ago when I was commentating on the Giro Rosa, and I guess the casual cycling fan would say to me, oh, isn't it awful that we don't have a women's Tour de France? And I'd say, yeah, but there is a stage race, a grand tour essentially happening right now. And they'd be like, is there? And the amount of people that didn't know there was any way of getting any coverage, didn't even know what was happening, because they were just, as you say, they're putting eyeballs straight on the men's tour. And yeah, I think for a long time it's been that battle to actually remind people that aren't the absolute diehard fans of the sport that there is a women's grand tour happening. So yeah, to see that shift will be really good. But yeah, I really hope it doesn't come at the huge detriment to development teams.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I think the thinking used to be that for Italian viewers, Rai, who, you know, play out the men's Tour de France, they would, straight off the back of the end of the men's Tour de France, put in a kind of 15-minute highlights package from the Giro Rosa. So for those viewers, it was seen as, you know, possibly beneficial to kind of carry these people watching the men's tour across. But, you know, for any other nation, that just doesn't work. There are some other UCI changes, aren't they, there, Denny, that you were keen to touch on, that affect the female peloton a lot more than it does the men?
Yeah, well, UCI also dropped a list of equipment rule changes last week. And the key one is that there is now a new wider minimum measurement on handlebars. So the new rule states that handlebars cannot be narrower than 400 millimetres measured outside to outside at the drops, or 320 millimetres between the inside of the brake hoods. And that new rule will apply from January the 1st, 2026. And that supersedes the previous rule of 350 millimetres between the hoods. So that's quite a significant change. And I think the rationale behind that change is that bars have become narrower. There have been people that are saying it's quite dangerous having narrow bars in the peloton, and people have been doing it for kind of aero reasons, basically. But lots of female riders, lots of people in the women's peloton have raised concerns about this change because they feel that this change doesn't actually take account of women, full stop. It's just a change that's a kind of universally being applied. The fact that women can be a lot smaller, they just require smaller handlebars physiologically. So lots of people very concerned about this change. It feels like they feel like it's been made without consulting 51% of the stakeholders within the sport.
And this won't be the first time we've seen this in the sport, where, as you say, it does massively disproportionately affect the women. And I hope actually that the kind of vocal response to this change might make a difference. And I was looking back at the time that Phil Burt, the head physio at the time at Team Sky and at British Cycling, he was treating a lot of the female track squad who were coming into the likes of the World Championships, the Olympics, at that height of the sport. And there was a rule on saddle tilt that, again, was applicable across men's and women's cycling, where the women could not change the tilt of their saddles on the track to sit ultimately in a comfortable position. And when you're obviously doing like the team pursuit on the absolute rivet, they were really, really uncomfortable. And not even just uncomfortable, it can cause, as we know now, major problems to be sitting on a saddle that isn't suitable or suitably tilted. And so Phil Burt was really pivotal in getting a UCI rule change to say that the women could have a different saddle tilt. So I do really hope that if it is really detrimental to a lot of the women, that there may be a vocal mass of people that get it changed back for the women.
Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye out on that. UCI just doing things without consulting women. That's a shock moment. What, that could be an ooh moment, couldn't it? That should have been one of our like, ooh moments. Yeah. Or is it more like a
groan moment, isn't it?
More like a
not again moment.
But yeah, we'll keep eyes on that. Won't we? Right, well, I think we should leave it there. And well, we'll be back next month talking about all that happened at the Giro d'Italia women, which will be is the next Women's World Tour race on the calendar. And then we'll have already got another Grand Tour champion crowned. It's becoming more and more hard to tell where these major races are going to land, isn't it? So what can I promise you for next month? We'll have to go somewhere Italian, won't I? Some kind of beautiful terrace with a few three Aperol spritzes. That's what I'm promising now. We'll see where we end up. But Denny, you're going to have to start getting started on working out what your backdrop to your call is going to be for that. For our Italian,
maybe a nice episode. Italian lake, some figs, some Prosecco. Yeah. Yeah, I'm working on it now.
Oh,
yeah.
Very, very nice. And Rebecca, I'm sure if there's Aperol Spritz on offer, you will suddenly be here, won't you? But we'll all be together, I'm sure, if I offer an Aperol Spritz for it.
You had me at Prosecco. Hell, you had me at Spritz.
Well, thank you both for joining me with all your ooh moments. Let's hope there's plenty of ooh moments to come. That was a little bit saucy, actually, that one, wasn't it? We're not straying into ooh moments just yet. But yes, thank you very much, Denny.
Thank you, Rose. A pleasure as always.
And thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thanks so much.
And thank you, listeners.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn.
and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable Pocket Hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable Pocket Hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.